Boys, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio, brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC. You'll meet comedians Jack Pearl, Will Jordan, and Peter Donald after these words from the Burritt.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. You've heard about the new higher rates on savings accounts. Maybe you've seen ads that mention 7% or more interest on savings certificates. Well, a savings certificate is a special account. 2.5 years is the minimum term on the new 6.75% certificates. At the Big B, Burritt Mutual, they work like this. Deposit $1,000 in one of these certificates and leave it on deposit, and you'll earn even more than 6.75%. That's because Burritt pays you interest continuously, and the interest earns interest too. So the actual yield at maturity comes to 7.08% at the Big B. That's the straight story, the facts. That's what you'll get at any office of the Big B. In New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Member FDIC.
And now your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio collector Ed Corcoran.
Radio historian, Dick, you got the billing wrong here.
Ed, we have a wonderful lineup tonight. We couldn't expect to get three greater people, I think, on one show if we had planned this. We haven't planned it.
No, it's going to be three famous comedians from three different generations, I might add, you know, and I think there's going to be a thrill for everybody tonight.
All right, suppose we start over here on, we'll start on my right, and we'll meet a man, I think, whose voice is familiar to many, many people and through many great radio shows, Peter Donald. Peter, it's good to see you.
Oh, very nice to be here, too. Yeah, you're one from column A, you are two from column B, yeah?
That wasn't the voice I was expecting, Peter.
Well, I'm not long for this world.
That's
what is this
one.
Business about three generations? Where do I fit in there?
Well, you'll see in just a moment. We're going to talk to another young man who is certainly well-known on television, but Will Jordan, I understand you had a part in radio, too. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, they had these crystal sets at home, and this young kid, Jack Pearl, came around. I said, no, I just caught the sort of the tail end of the most of the action. I won the Godfrey Show, which was what we call a simulcast. It was on TV and radio at the same time, and I won the show. Remember when we did the show, the radio people said, talking to the mic, the TV people said, forget the mic, look at the camera. I ignored both of them and played to the studio audience, and I was one of the early winners.
And here we are working in a hotel room.
Yeah. And it was a great thrill to win the Godfrey Show because it led to a 2-year layoff. But one of the good things about the, also another local show I did by Bob Smith, and that was the same Bob Smith of Howdy Doody fame before he had Howdy Doody. He had a regular variety show. And I was doing some impersonations, and without my knowledge, the wonderful, great Fred Allen was watching me. And he called my agent up, and he got an interpreter to speak my agent's language. And we worked out a deal, and I appeared on his show in April of 1949 with some impersonations. At that time, he wanted me to impersonate Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant, and John Garfield. And it was a very thrilling and frightening experience for me. He was such a wonderful man. He said, I remember at rehearsal, he said that if you don't like these jokes, we'll rewrite them. Of course, I wasn't about to criticize him. However, he did rewrite the gags and make them better.
Will you do a voice or two for us a little later?
Well, the impressions I did then, I don't know if they'd be as popular today as they were then. I did a John Garfield. Sure. I remember the line he said, He said, what are you doing, John? I said, I'm in a play. At that time, there was a play on Broadway called The Big Knife. I said, Ma, I got the lead in a great play called The Big Knife. And she said, big deal. 15 years in show business and you're still carrying a spear.
I'd like to interject something here because it's corollary to what Will said about Fred Allen saying, if you don't like these jokes, we'll rewrite them. The modesty of the man, being one of the greatest wits of all time and one of the greatest writers and a fine editor, too. He was that modest. He didn't think that his writing staff and his own sense of humor were the be-all, end-all. When I was doing Ajax Cassidy on the show for, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks, the writers with Fred, they weren't quite catching the nature of the man. I knew such a little Irishman, which is where I got the character. But it didn't scan. The things they were writing just didn't come out of this little man's mouth. And I actually asked the producer of the show, Howard Riley, if I might resign. And he says, resign from this show, which was the holy of holies. Everybody wanted to be on that. Nobody resigns from this. You don't sell U.S. Steel, you know. And I said, well, I'm not entirely comfortable with it. He said, well, I'll take it to the chief. And Fred came flying back to me and he said, I understand you're not exactly comfortable. I said, well, it doesn't scan quite the way. I said, well, therefore, I'm not doing my best for you. Well, he said, would you be willing to sit in on the cutting session? He said, it'll take a little extra time on Sunday, but he said, I like to keep the Imglick away from people, but he said, if you're willing to give us half an hour, we'd like you to help us write the jokes. The upshot of that was that I not only moved into doing little polishing and cutting on my own stuff, but I was on the rewrite session for about, between 5 and 7 years, for no pay, but for the joy of working with the man, and that's how it came about. He was very modest about his own thing. He said, if you don't care for this, we'll write another one. And I often said since that the very pleasure of working with Fred offstage in the writing sessions may have added 10 years to my life and 10 years which I would very gladly have given him.
Mm-hmm. And that somehow brings us to Mr. Cassidy's door. Well, let's arouse the placid Mr. Cassidy. How are you this glorious evening?
Oh, terrible, terrible, terrible. I can't sleep. I'm always dreaming.
Dreaming, eh?
Oh, last night I dreamed I was a tiddly. I didn't get a wink all night.
Hey, Jack, you are a problem.
That's not all for this world.
Now, tell me, Mr. Cassidy, what was your reaction to these Pulitzer Awards?
Well, I was amazed to end when the advisory committee found no dramatic play worthy of the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, what play do you think should have won it?
Mrs. McGee and the Muppet.
Oh.
And the play was presented by Orson Monaghan and the Glockamora Theatre Guild.
Was Mrs. McGee and the Muffin?
Oh, it had tug at your heartstrings till the front of your shirt is all baggy.
It's dramatic, eh?
Oh, my, very dramatic. As the curtain rises, there's 7 dead bodies on the floor. And Mrs. McGee enters with the Muffin and swoons. The curtain comes down to the end of Act 1.
Gone.
Sobbing and crying, the entire audience steps next door into Kerrigan.
Yes.
And there, with a round of drinks, they fortify themselves for the second act.
And after the intermission?
In the second act, Mr. McGee falls off the mantelpiece and he kills 3 children who are playing leapfrog on the linoleum.
Oh.
Mrs. McGee picks up her muffin.
Yes.
The curtain comes down. Moaning and wailing, the audience goes back into Kerrigan to drown their sorrow.
Well, how long does this go on?
Oh, there's 7 acts in the play.
And every intermission, the audience goes back into Kerrigan?
In a body.
Why, the audience spends more time in Kerrigan's saloon than it does in the theater.
And who do you think produced the play?
Who?
Kerrigan!
Certainly one of the giants in the field of radio. We're about to meet another one, and Ed, I'm going to let you introduce our third guest on tonight's Golden Age of Radio.
Well, of course, his most famous contribution is putting Cincinnati on the map, but at the same time, he's a contemporary of such people as Al Jolson, Eddie Cantor, really one of the great men in the history of entertainment business, Jack Pearl.
Jack Pearl, it's a pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Well, I want to thank you, too, for inviting me up here. And it's quite a thrill to hear both Will Jordan and the little Irishman over there. They're real friends, you know. And the thrill of it all is to think that you have survived maybe two or three really generations in show business. You know, today, the youngsters, there is so much great talent. Oh, it's abundance of great talent. Only trouble is that I find today, this is my own little opinion, it's the permissiveness of today, which weren't allowed in our day. My opening program, the Baron and Charlie were brand new people. Had never been, we were on the Ziegfeld Chrysler Hour, but not as the Baron and Charlie. Jack Pearl and Cliff Hall, because he was in the Follies with me. Charlie said to me, "Where have you been, Baron?" And I said, "I was all over the world and I was shipwrecked. And here I was on this island for 2.5 years. He said, "All alone?" I said, "All alone." "Oh, no." I said, "I had a little mermaid. For 2.5 years, she used to bring up all the delicacies of the ocean. And she used to cook it for me, and we fell madly in love. Oh, what a love. She was such a wonderful. One day a ship came, wanted to get me aboard. And I said, "Fine." As they pulled the gangplank down, I stepped up and I said, "Would you kindly take my sweetheart?" And the captain said, "No, this is a maritime. That belongs to the maritime. I can't take this woman with you." I said, "But this is my love." And as I'm going up the gangplank, she said to me, "Baron, you're going to regret this the longest day you live. If you leave me, you're going to regret it." And Cliff said to me, Charlie said to me, "Did you regret it?" I said, "Yes." This morning, he said, "Well, don't cry. Tell me." I said, "This morning I opened a can of sardines. They all jumped up and said, 'Hello, Papa.'"
That's a beautiful joke.
And they thought, now let me tell you this. This is not, God rest his soul, Mr. Aylesworth was the president of NBC at the time. Yeah. Called me, he was a personal friend of mine. Called me up in his office and he said, "Jack, you are not going to last on radio if you're going to tell stories like that." They thought it was dirty.
Jack, how was the Baron born?
Well, the Baron was born by a great creative writer. I was with the Ziegfeld Follies. The Follies closed. I was re-signed to go back to do the new Ziegfeld Follies. In the interim, Ziegfeld had a program with Mr. Chrysler. Eddie Dowling, great, great actor as well as a great writer and producer on Broadway, he wrote the show. And the show was this, that one star that Mr. Ziegfeld had presented in any one of his shows would be on. Well, his great favorite was Will Rogers. And I thought second would be either Fanny Bryce or Ed Wynn or Kant or any. But he gave me the honor. And I happened to do old jokes, older because it was a new format. It was a new play toy for people. Radio, it's just 1931. And he kept me on all the time, and American Tobacco Company heard about this, and this is this great writer, this wonderful man, Billy K. Wells. And he said, "Well, we're going to combat Amos and Andy, and we'll get a German comedian," and this is how it was formed. And he wrote the greatest jokes. Today would be good, because it was jokes that were clean. Let me put it this way. I hate to be repetitious. But we had a greater world. Everybody's carrying a chip on their shoulder today. Now, Peter just did Irish. I can do various dialects. He can do various dialects. Will Jordan can do various dialects. When we did dialects and we portrayed a character, we didn't want to degrade the people. You see, if an Italian wants to speak in English, but he's thinking in Italian. Mm-hmm. Now, if he couldn't come to work, and he wanted to tell his boss. Now, how is he going to say that? "Excuse me, boss?" No, he's got to say, "Scusi me, boss. I non ci cane come to work esse neither. I no work hard." Now, he's not mimicking. He's speaking English. And if a Jew Says, last night I sat in my house. Nobody was there, only me. And I'm in the paper, and a man comes in. He says, how do you feel? I don't know this man. I looked around. There he was. Now, I'm not mimicking. I'm telling a character. Well, you can't do that today.
No, that's right. You can't. We're a bit more sensitive, I guess. Now,
why? Because I think we've become so self-conscious that you've taken away, as I said before, you take away the ingredients. When you use salt and pepper for the soup, just to give you a little more of a taste, well, the same with the dialect. If a Frenchman is saying, où je peux aller mon, et comparer de soi la chambre, douzoir durer mon comble. You know what I said?
I have no idea.
Either way, I don't speak it.
Beautiful. I'm glad I didn't bite on that one, Jack. You know, we're talking about the Baron. We haven't mentioned the Baron's full name for those listeners who might not remember or may not have been around when he was on the radio.
Well, it was Baron Munchausen.
That's right. And Jack, who was your associate and who played the part of Charlie?
Cliff Hall, a brilliant actor. He was not only a great straight man, had a beautiful speaking voice.
I want to talk to Peter Donald about the idea of dialects. Do you think you could do Ajax Cassidy today without receiving a number of letters and phone calls criticizing you?
Strangely enough, I got a couple of phone calls in those good old days. To back up what Jack said, those of us who did dialects, we were delineating types that were familiar to everybody because we had just followed a great influx of immigration. So there was usually an Italian barber on your block or a German butcher or an Irish policeman, and these were recognizable types. And we did them if we were people of taste, and I would like to point out that the performers in this room were and are, including yours truly. You would not do anything to hurt anybody, so therefore what you did was caricature but never ridicule. It's like drawing a funny picture. A cartoonist makes the nose a little bigger or the ears a little longer or the eyes a little more close for comic effect. But it was not meant to put down the people, no denigration at all. And we did it with love and affection, and they were nice little people, and we all had them living in, particularly in New York City or any cosmopolis. We had the foreign types who had come over, or even the second generations. So we were delineating types that everybody was familiar with.
Well, Peter, I think that you've explained the background of the dialectician very well, and I'd like our audience to hear a bit of your work on the air when you were doing the show Can You Top This? And we've put together four different excerpts from that show. We've got dialects and character impersonations as only you can do them. Peter Donald, ladies and gentlemen, and Can You Top This?
Well, anyway, this is about a lady speaker, a lady speechmaker, and she was holding forth on temperance and the evils of dissipation. She said, now, most men today do not take proper care of themselves. They keep late hours and don't get any sleep. They smoke entirely too much, and all they think of is having a good time and drinking that terrible whiskey. Oh, that whiskey! Now, after all, what good does it do you? Where can you get it? I mean, where does it get it? So she's going on this harangue, and all of a sudden she noticed one guy down the third row in the audience. He's listening very, very carefully. But she said, now, there is a gentleman who looks as if he lives a good life. Yes, you right there. Now, a young man, do you travel the straight and narrow? And this guy says, yes, I certainly do. He says, it would be just too bad for me if I didn't, Lee. It'd be just too bad. She said, oh, that's wonderful. You see, that proves my point. You mean, young man, you're afraid of the consequences if you don't follow the straight and narrow. He says, yeah, you can say that again, lady. I certainly do have to follow the straight and narrow. I'm a tightrope walker.
Here we go with our second joke of the evening, though. This was sent in by Miss Cynthia G. Mellons of New York City. And the subject is Professor. Professor. So, Peter, you can hold class on this one, if you will, please.
Well, Herkimer Jerkimer was going to night school, And he was studying some very deep stuff, this new thing all about the atom bomb and the splitting the atom, and he was learning all about this uranium and uridium and your father's mustache and all that. But the professor wasn't satisfied that Herkimer and all the other people in the class were paying any attention. He kind of figured they were drowsing off in the middle of the lectures, so he thought he'd catch him off base by putting a little double talk into the lecture.
So he said, and now, pupils, he said, you take the loose section of dendered schmaug, and you gweld them, being very careful to overheat the brow tabs or the fortis scruven. Then he says you extract and womp them gently for about a time and a half, twangle each one twice, then swiftly frankenforce the appenstay in a blinger if you have one handy. Otherwise, he says, discriminate the entire instrument in twetchels. Now, are there any questions? Herkimer put his hand up. He says, yeah, Professor, just one. What the heck are twetchels?
Well, this is about a newspaper reporter. He worked for a newspaper called The Upper Plate. Comes out every night. And he was interviewing a very, very interesting old man. Very interesting old man. This old guy was 80 years old, and yet every single day he raced along the roads on a bicycle. Every single day. He was always seen pedaling up and down these highways. So the reporter said, Mr. Wilson, he said to the old man, he said, is it true that you are an octogenarian? So the guy said, yes, sir. He said, that's what I am. I'm an octogenarian. And they tell me if I live another 20 years, I'm going to be a centipede. He says, now, young man, he says, stop moving around like that. Sit still. You almost knocked down a picture of my pinup girl there. He said, ain't she cute? Little Carrie Nation, I remember her well. He says, now, young man, come on with this interview. You got any other questions you want to ask me? He said, well, sir, he said, you might answer this one. Is it true that you ride a bicycle down the highways every day? He said, yes, sir. He said, that's what I do. Around these parts, I'm known as the Green Hornet with liver pills. That's me. He says, well, this is amazing. A man 80 years of age. He says, you mean every day, in spite of the weather, you're out on that bicycle? He says, yes, sir, every single day, except the month of July. Well, he says, why not the month of July? He says, well, I can't ride my bicycle in July because that's the month that the fella that puts me on and lifts me off goes on vacation.
Fellas, through all this clowning around tonight, I don't know where the time's gone, but I think we have time to hear Pete tell his end of this next interest. And Pete, don't make a bum out of me. Now prove it, will you, with a story sent in by Mrs. Marjorie Douglas of Brooklyn, New York, on the subject of building. Building.
Well, this is about my friend Mr. Fafufnik. And he was feeling marvelous because the telephone company finally installed a phone in his office. And he had a wonderful time. He's practicing working the dial and he's singing, dialing, je vous aime beaucoup, daddle, daddle, daddle. And just then, the phone rang, you see. And he said, hey, is that a marvelous invention? He says, they just put it in my office already. Somebody's giving me a tinkle. Picks up the receiver. He says, hello, Fafufnik, Fafufnik, and Fafufnik. You're talking to the one in the middle. He said, who's this? So the phone said, he says, for goodness sake, my old friend Quentin Slobodkin. He says, what's on your mind, Slobby? So the phone says, he says, what, you want I shall lend you a bottle of scotch? He says, listen, you've been borrowing so much liquor recently, the Madison Loan Company's got hiccups. What are you doing here? He said, all right, I feel good today, I'll bring it right over. He says, where's your office? He says, uh-huh. He says, 4721 Broadway, the Amalgamated Building. I'll take the left bank of elevators, go up to the 54th floor to the third door on the left. So he goes down to this office, and he's strolling along, sees the building, goes in the building, he gets to the elevator. He says, you'll give me the 54th floor if you'll be so cooperative. The operator says, I'm sorry, sir, you must be in the wrong building. We don't have 54 floors. He says, wait a minute, this ain't the Amalgamated Building. He says, no, sir. He says, that's next door. This building only has 30 floors. He said, all right, sir, take me up to the 34th floor. Why should I waste your time?
Why should you waste anybody's time? Easter brings us to AIDS. I won't say what that joke got, but just for luck, we'll send Mrs. Marjorie Douglas $25 and 6 Kugel boxes of pure white Kirkland flakes. So join Canyon Topless again next week, same time, same gang, other jokes, some new, some old. And until then, we remain yours for bigger and better laughs.
Senator Ford.
Harry Hirschfield.
Joe Laurie Jr.
What went wrong?
It's Ward Wilson.
And Wash White for Kirkland flakes.
Good fun. Peter Donald and Can You Top This? We'll be back with our guests right after this.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Corcoran. Brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889, and by WTIC.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. Confused by all the ads about new, higher interest rates on savings accounts? Many people are. Some banks are advertising 5% as a top rate. Some are even advertising rates over 7% on special types of accounts. Well, these are the facts. Federal regulations control the amounts that financial institutions can pay you. And only thrift institutions like Burritt Mutual Savings Bank can pay you the maximum amounts controlled by law. For example, 5.25% is the new legal rate allowed on regular accounts at savings banks. That's the top rate allowed. No one can pay you more. Some banks can't pay you as much. To get all the facts, get to the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Burritt Mutual Savings, the money place. Member FDIC.
This is Dick Bertel along with Ed Corcoran here on the Golden Age of Radio, and tonight we're saluting the comedy years on radio with three giants, Jack Pearl, Will Jordan, and Peter Donald. And Peter, before we talk to Jack and Will again, I want to get back to this area of dialects, because they were so prevalent 25 years ago when you were doing radio. Are young comedians doing dialects at all today?
It's interesting to note, I was at a place in New York City not long ago where a bunch of young performers got up. It's one of these restaurants where they give young actors a chance. It's called Catch a Rising Star is the name of the place. And they got up in the same vein that we're talking about, and they were doing the new immigrants, and most of them were doing the Puerto Ricans.
That's right.
I said, hey, man, I want to tell you something, kid. Hey, listen, you know, sometimes you pick very funny, you pick with an accent. And now they're doing the new immigrants. Mm-hmm. And everybody was rolling on the floor because that's what they understand now. But, of course, the Baron, I think one point, and I must throw this in because of people who will, of course, anybody who heard Baron Munchausen will remember the character. But Jack's character was predicated on a real, or perhaps fictitious, German baron who was a great liar. Wasn't that the premise, Jack?
Right, right.
Was that he was always telling tall stories. Now, tall stories, with or without dialect, those are timeless. We all have blowhards and liars all over the place.
You know, it isn't the story itself. Forgive me, Peter, I want to do a little Irish story, which is true. Now, this man loved his whiskey. Now, why do they say that? Because the Irish like to drink. The Jew is close with his money. The Scotchman is tight, you know? So that each one has its
modesty.
a little idiosyncrasies. Now, this little Irishman loved this one saloon. Now, had he gone through the cemetery, he'd have got to his house in 5 minutes. But no, he had an aversion to going through that, and he walked around. Well, this day he drank and drank, and he pushed his coat up and pulled his trousers up, and he says, now I'm going out. I'm going through the cemetery, he says. And he goes in there, and there's a newly dug grave for burial in the morning, and he's so drunk he falls asleep right in there. And just as dawn is breaking, he rubs his eyes, and he looks around, and he sees all these tombstones. He says, my God, it's the day of resurrection. He says, and I'm the first one up.
All right.
Now, there's no harm in telling that little story.
No, not at all.
Excuse me.
Another story.
Can you top this? It's like the fellow on the Saturday night, and he got his paycheck, and he's in a rather belligerent mood.
And he says, oh, you know what I'm going to do? He says, it's very boring around this place. He says, I'm going to create a little havoc. He says, I'm going to walk, I'm going to find a big brick, and I'm going to throw the rock, and I'm going to break every window on the block. And he does. He goes around smashing all the store windows. He says, no, I'm going to kick over all the garbage cans, and I'm going to spill the swill all over the street. And he does. He turns over all the garbage cans. He says, no, let me see. No, let me see. He said, I think I'll find myself a big policeman, and I'm going to belt him one right in the chops.
Well, he finds a cop, and he starts to swing on him, and the cop grabs him, and he shakes him. He says, what's the matter with you? You drunk or something? Are you crazy?
He says, no, no, officer. I can explain it very easy. You see, I'm on my way to confession, and I'm a little short of material.
Will, do you do dialects, and do people
yes.
accept them today?
Well, believe it or not, I did start out doing dialects before. I became a mimic purely by accident. As Peter was noting in the car on the way up, he said, you sound like James Mason. James Mason was the first impression I ever did, and it was purely accidental. I started as a comedian, and then I became an actor. I went to dramatic school with classmates who have done very well, Jason Robards, Don Rickles, Tom Post, and these were my buddies back at school. And but I figured I'd be an actor. And I had to get an English accent. So I went to see a film called The Seventh Veil, which was, I think, James Mason's first American released
yeah,
film.
Yeah, in time with it.
And I didn't want to impersonate James Mason. What I was trying to do was to develop the English accent to tell a joke. Now, what happened was, unlike these two talented fellas, I got an applause for impersonating James Mason before I ever got to the punchline. And it's very frustrating for me, and this is what happened. Every time I would do a character, the character would, would sound like an impersonation, and I got an applause, and people began to completely ignore my material. And I was kind of proud of some of the material I had written. And this is the way it went, and then several years later, I was doing a little local show of my own in New York on Channel 12, which is amazing because we don't have a Channel 12 in New York. It was a ghost from 11, I think, my show. But I was doing impressions of the people that were popular then, Dave Garraway, Robert Q. Lewis, Dagmar, Jerry Lester, and Ed Sullivan. And he saw me and he said, I've never seen anybody imitate me before. I'd like to have you do it on the show. And I was nervous, imitating him. And in 1953, I did an impression of him exactly the way I thought he looked and sounded. And it was a flop. It didn't go over at all. A year later, Hi Gardner, several other people had seen me do it and said, you've got to use this guy, Will Jordan. And Sullivan said, I had him on, nothing happened. In that year, between 53 and 54, I was doing it in nightclubs and playing with it. I was doing his voice as a baritone, which is the way it really sounds. And I raised it up to a tenor because I thought a tenor sounded funny. He's not a tenor, incidentally. But I knew that as a tenor, most mimics will change the baritones to tenors because it works funnier. I knew that he said Big Shoe, and that wasn't too funny, so I changed Big one night, don't ask me why, in some little club I invented really big, and I changed Show to Shoe, and I knew that he held his hands pretty close to his head, to his chest. One day I reversed the palms and cracked my knuckles. I shook my shoulders, rolled my eyes, burped, spun around, did a whole lot of crazy things, which Ed has never done. Then every critic said in 1954, the devastating impression Will Jordan does is exactly like the real Ed Sullivan. I thought, how funny, in 53, when I was really like him, no one said it was anything. But when I was
doing you.
That's what came later. Then, a few months later, there was something like 200 comedians doing Ed Sullivan. Ed said he actually felt compelled. When people would meet him in real life, they would say, well, when are you going to crack your knuckles? And he said, I don't do that. That's Will Jordan. But eventually, of course, he just had to do it. But he would, in his shows, in the late 50s, he would always say, as Will Jordan would say, we have a really big show. It's amazing. People don't seem to, remember having heard him say that, but he said it many, many, many times. And I've never seen anybody, exception of Johnny Biner recently, who ever imitated Ed Sullivan. I've only seen people that imitate me imitating it.
A mimic of a mimic.
I think we ought to bring in Ed. I wish we could bring in Ed Sullivan at this point, because Ed did have a radio show back in the early 30s, but unfortunately no recordings exist. And I do want to represent that era of comedy on our show tonight. So we've turned to an excerpt from the Al Jolson program from Ed's collection. This goes back to 1938, I believe, and... rather interesting if you listen to it, because you'll hear the Parkia Carcass, who is the guest on the show, makes some rather interesting political observations about the isolationism of the United States at that time. Let's listen.
Heine.
Yes, Al, what is it?
Heine, isn't Parker Carter supposed to come on here right after my song?
Parker Carter? Say, I'm sorry, Al, I forgot all about it. Parker left two notes this morning.
Yeah?
Now, maybe that'll explain his lateness there.
Let me see. It says, Dear Jocelyn, the early bird catches the worm, but who needs worms? So I'll be a little late tonight. If you want me in a hurry, you can call me at the Roxy, but I won't be there, so you can try the Capitol because I'll be at Minsky's. Tiny, how do you like a guy like that? He knows we have a broadcast, and he goes to shows. Why, that careless, thoughtless, scatterbrained, good-for-nothing, Tiny, I'd like to wring his neck. Here's some more letter. P.S. You wouldn't say that if I were there. Tiny, look. We've got to teach him a lesson. Lock the door and don't let him in.
I'm sorry, Al. I'm afraid it's too late. That sounds like park your carcass coming now.
How do you like it, Tiny?
Hello, Jackson.
Now, listen.
Where?
Parky, you know something? Sometimes I get so mad at you, I don't know what to do. But then I take a look at that innocent puss of yours and I melt. Now, tell me, where were you till now? Come on, tell Jolie. Why haven't I seen you all week?
Well, Jackson, I'll make a long story immaterial.
Yeah?
You see, I've been very busy campaigning for the coming election.
Now, wait a minute, Parky. What do you know about politics? Do you know how to get votes?
Oh, sure. I know how to handle all the messes.
Really?
Yeah. After all, don't forget, I'm one of the common people.
Yeah?
Of which I am the most common.
But, Parky, look, I didn't know you dabbled in politics.
Oh, sure. My whole family is politicians.
Yeah?
You know my brother, Harris?
Yeah?
He's an assemblyman.
An assemblyman in the New York legislature?
No, he's an assemblyman in the Chrysler Automobile plant. But my older brother, Kaporis.
Kaporis?
You know, he's a political taxidermist.
Now, wait a minute. A political taxidermist?
Yeah.
What does he do?
He stuffs ballot boxes. But my uncle, Dimitris.
Dimitris?
Yeah, he's in politics, too.
Oh, really?
He's got a restaurant in Washington, D.C.
In Washington, D.C.?
He feeds all the congressmen and all the senators.
Yeah?
That makes him Secretary of the Interior.
Oh, yeah. Listen, Parky. I know your uncle, Dimitris. I really do. I eat in his restaurant. Now,
yeah?
I don't want to say his food is bad, you understand?
Yeah.
I don't want to say it's bad, but Parky...
Right.
I couldn't digest it.
But he's got a new system now.
Really?
Yeah. With every meal, he gives everybody a small magazine to read.
What good is that?
That helps the Reader's Digest. But listen, my cousin Gregorius, is that a politician?
Gregorius?
He's running for an office, and you know, Jackson, the first thing he did was to hire 25 stenographers.
25 stenographers? What kind of a political office needs 25 stenographers?
He wants to be a dictator.
Oh.
And listen, he's going to do something... Listen to this. That kid is going to do something bigger than all the other dictators put together.
What is he going to do?
As soon as he's elected, he's going to give the whole world 24 hours to get out of town.
Well, Parky, we don't have to worry over here. You see, this is the greatest fortified country in the world.
Yeah.
The Atlantic to the east,
mm-hmm.
The Pacific to the west, the Rio Grande to the south,
yeah.
And the St. Lawrence to the north. What more do we need?
We need more boats. We got plenty of water.
Well, And wait a minute, Parky. Speaking of politics.
Yeah.
Come here. This is off the record.
Yeah.
Now, You don't have to answer this if you don't want to.
Yeah.
But, who are you supporting this year? Who are you supporting this year?
Same as last year, wife and eight relatives.
Oh, no. No, what I mean is, what party do you like?
Oh, I like a party where I eat like a horse and then go home. That's
right. You don't understand. I'm referring to a political party.
Oh.
For instance, the elephant represents the Republican,
yeah.
And the donkey stands for the Democrat.
Oh, I know what you mean. The emblem of my party is the reindeer.
The reindeer?
Yeah.
What kind of a party is that?
A stag party.
What?
Yeah.
Look, Parky, look. Let me acquaint you with something.
Yeah.
Come here. Now, look, in order to get into politics, you've got to know how to deal with people. You must be able to make yourself understood to the average man. That's very important. For instance, what would you say to a layman? Now, what would you say to a layman?
Hello, Governor.
Goodbye, Parky. Get out of here.
Al Jolson and Parky Carcass, who incidentally was more closely associated with Eddie Cantor. Jack Pearl, I've got one for you, because really, Phil Baker was one of your contemporaries, inasmuch as your show was on in the early and mid-30s. And Phil Baker, who was known as the Armor Star Jester, was on from, I think, 1933 to 1940. And this show goes back to 1935 with the famous British butler and the heckling stooge, Bottle and Beetle. Here's Phil Baker.
Presenting the Armor Star Jester, Phil Baker. Oh, my public. Oh. Ladies and gentlemen, before beginning the program, we will have half a minute's silence, during which we ask you to rise and face Yankee Stadium as a mark of respect to all those who bet on Primo Canera.
Oh, I say. I say, Mr. Baker. Mr. Baker, have you heard the rumor about Canera's alibi?
No, Bottle. What rumor?
Well, it seems they're going to take the yarn that Canera is telling about why he lost the fight and weave it into a rug.
Oh, I see. Bottle, for shame.
Oh, forgive me, Mr. Baker. I'm not myself. No, I was away over the fourth.
Yeah? When are you coming back? Where did you go over the fourth, Bottle?
Well, I went to visit my father.
Oh, really? How is he, Bart?
Oh, splendid, thank you. Yes, his position has been advanced.
Really?
Yes, sir. He's a trustee now.
He is. Just a jolly good fellow, eh?
By the way, Mr. Baker, what did you do over the fourth, sir?
Well, Bottle, my wife and I had a general house cleaning. We got rid of a lot of useless things that were laying around the house. First of all, I threw out my wife's brother.
Really?
Yes. Then I dusted off my grandfather.
Yes.
Took up all my uncles for the summer and beat them. And dropped a little poison around for the ants.
Oh, I say. Oh, quite a thorough cleaning, sir.
Yes, yes. And I swept out two relatives I didn't even know I had. Oh, and another thing. I was going through an old wallet.
Yes.
Get this, Bottle.
Yes.
I was going through an old wallet and I found my wife's hand in it. Wasn't that lucky?
Oh, yes. Rather. What else did you do, sir?
Oh, I hung my maid out for an airing. Sprayed the children and polished off the landlord.
Yes.
Then I went out in the garden and clipped the neighbor's children.
Oh, I say, you must have worked very hard, Mr.
Yeah, Baker. Especially last night when I went to the basement and shook down my rich cousin. Then I went out and got myself replastered.
Ah, yes, the glorious fourth. Yes, the glory. Don't look now, Mr. Baker, but here comes Leon Belasco.
Oh, yeah? Hello, Leon.
God blimey, well, if it isn't Phil Baker, or do my eyes deceive you?
Say, Leon, what's the matter? You look different. You look good. Doesn't Mr. Belasco look good, Bottle?
Oh, quite rather. Yes, indeed, I'll say.
Why, Leon, I never saw you with so much color in your face, and your face is so full.
Thank you, Phil.
Well, how did you do it?
I've got poison ivory.
Oh. By the way, Leon, where were you over the fourth?
Well, at night, my wife and I gave a party.
Really?
She did all the cooking. Oh, boy, was it obnoxious.
Well, I can imagine. What did you have for dinner, Leon?
Stuffed guests.
Stuffed guests. No, what did you have on the table?
My elbows.
Don't confuse the issue. What was on the plate?
Fingerprints.
Leon, for the last time I ask you, what did you eat?
Nothing. My wife lost the can opener.
Oh. Well, everyone's been accounted for except Beetle. I wonder what Beetle did over the fourth.
I went to visit my mother and father.
How touching, Beetle. Did you see them?
No, they were out with the chauffeur. They went to town to get their relief check.
Well, Beetle boy, tell me, did you shoot off any firecrackers?
Just one, under an old lady. Boy, did she jump.
How do you like that guy? Where'd you get the firecracker, Beetle?
I took it away from a little boy.
You must have enjoyed yourself. What else did you do yesterday?
I went down and let the Normandy look at me.
Oh, Phil, he is terrible. Why do you let him get away with you? If I were you, do you know what that would do to me?
Yeah, beat you within an inch of your dialect.
Now, look here, Beetle. You can't talk to Leon like that. You can't insult him.
I know. I've tried.
That's adding insult to ingenuity.
Yeah.
I'm going someplace where I'll be depreciated.
You're right, Leon. That guy, Beetle, is so narrow-minded, he could put his head in a slot machine. And besides, at a time like this, we should pay tribute to our great country. Yesterday, we celebrated the anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Just think, Bottle. Uncle Sam is 159 years old.
Oh, really, Mr. Baker? He doesn't look a day over 35.
Seriously, but I think the United States is the greatest country in the world.
Well, Mr. Baker, I think England is the greatest country in the world.
Don't be foolish, Bottle. What has England got that America hasn't got?
American tourists.
Yeah. Ain't it the truth? I admire your patriotism, Bottle, but I think that France is a greater country than England.
Ah, but England is the country of letters.
Ah, but France is a country of postcards.
Ah, but England has Beatrice Lilly.
Ah, but England hasn't got Phil Baker.
Ah, when does the next boat leave for England?
Mm-hmm. And another thing, Bottle, in this country we have Congress, the greatest minds in the world. What have you in England to compare with the Congress in Washington?
The fog in London.
Don't swear, Bottle. The fog lifts.
Oh, very good, sir. But if you wish to make further comparisons between the English and Americans, match these, sir. Let's see. King George.
President Roosevelt.
Sir Malcolm Campbell.
The New York taxi drivers.
The Royal Guard of Buckingham Palace.
The ushers at the Chicago Theater.
Mahatma Gandhi.
Sally Rand.
The London Zoo.
The Baker Family Album.
The Phil Baker Show and the part of Bottle was played, incidentally, by Harry McNaughton. We'll be back to our guests, Jack Pearl, Will Jordan, and Peter Donald right after this.
This message about saving money is brought to you by the Big B, Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, the money place. You've heard about the new higher rates on savings accounts. Maybe you've seen ads that mention 7% or more interest on savings certificates. Well, a savings certificate is a special account. 2.5 years is the minimum term on the new 6.75% certificates. At the Big B, Burritt Mutual, they work like this. Deposit $1,000 in one of these certificates and leave it on deposit, and you'll earn even more than 6.75%. That's because Burritt pays you interest continuously, and the interest earns interest too. So the actual yield at maturity comes to 7.08% at the Big B. That's the straight story, the facts. That's what you'll get at any office of the Big B in New Britain, West Hartford, Glastonbury, Wethersfield and Rocky Hill, and now in Newington. Member FDIC.
We're saluting the comedy years on the Golden Age of Radio tonight with Will Jordan, Peter Donald, and Jack Pearl, or Baron Munchausen, as perhaps most of you remember him. And Jack, I want to talk about that show and about the character, and especially about Cliff Hall. Why was Cliff Hall known as Charlie? Who came up with that name?
The author thinking his name was Charlie Hall instead of Cliff Hall.
Oh.
And he said, when he doubts you, just say, what's you there, Charlie?
Charlie Hall was a very fine comedian of the day. He was always the foil for Laurel and Hardy.
Oh, I didn't realize that. We're talking with Irish Brinson, incidentally, of Bridgeport, who in his own right is a collector, and you've got your own radio show, haven't you?
That's right. We produce something called Tales from Beyond with Raymond Edward Johnson, the old voice of the Inner Sanctum.
You want to do the part of Cliff Hall for us?
I'll play Charlie here for the Baron.
Okay, well, set the scene, right. Jack.
Baron, I hear you just came over from the other side. How'd you come?
I was traveling. I came over on a ship.
On a ship?
No, on a ship, yes.
On a ship. A ship.
Yes, listen, never mind where I was. I was traveling all over the world. I was in Venice.
You mean Venice?
You see, I was... Hello?
I said Venice.
Venice, yes, Venice.
No, Venice. Ven.
Last month, Ven. Once in a Ven. What do you mean, Ven? I was traveling on this ship. It was the funniest thing I ever saw in my whole life. You know, on the ship was over 900 chefs.
I don't believe you, Baron. 900 chefs? What kind of ship was it?
I don't know. It must have been a cook's tour. Yeah, that's true. So if it's not true, I hope I dropped dead on this spot. Oh, excuse me. I had to move. You know, and another thing I want to tell you, Charlie, I was traveling on the road here just only the other day. What day was that? This was Wednesday's.
You mean Wednesday?
Yeah, Wednesday. In the center of the week, you know. This was about 9 o'clock. You
9 see, o'clock a.m. or p.m.?
So I'm coming from, what was that?
I say 9 o'clock a.m. or p.m.
Yeah. That's good. So I'm traveling along the road, you
I
see.
Said 9 o'clock, Baron, 9 o'clock a.m. or p.m.?
No, A-Z.
A-Z?
Yeah, after supper. My goodness, that stuff that you give me here.
Baron, I heard you had some trouble with the food on board the ship.
With the food, yeah, with every... That's the funniest thing in the whole world. With every meal, I had to eat soup.
Was it compulsory?
You see, I was coming from... I don't get you.
I said, was it compulsory?
No, tomato soup.
Oh, that's beautiful. Jack, thanks so much for being our guest.
Listen, it takes a little time to even remember that old joke. You know, it's a funny thing. I must say this before we go. I want to see the youngsters come up. I think that if somebody with some great wisdom would take these young kids, take them in stock for 1 year, give them a good training, dialects, dancing, singing. The theater needs them. The radio needs them. Television needs them. You know, you can't just go out and talk of sex all the time. It's like the two little Jewish women are talking. One says to the other, what do you think of sex? And the other lady says, I think it's the best department store on Fifth Avenue.
Jack Pearl, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Ed, it's been great fun tonight getting together with these three funny men.
Well, Dick, I think of that word, can you top this? I don't think we ever can. This has really been sensational. I never laughed so much in my life.
Well, Ed, we're not going to be laughing next month. Next month, we're going to be sending chills up and down the spines of our audience, hopefully, because our guest is Howard Duff, who created Sam Spade on radio. Do you remember how that show opened?
The Adventures of Sam Spade, Detective.
Detective Agency.
Hello, sweetheart. It's only me.
Oh, Sam. Why so modest?
Women, Effie. Age cannot weather nor customs stale their infinite variety.
Huh?
Against their incalculable wiles, mere man is a leaf in the wind.
Oh, Sam, do you really... Oh. Who was she and how windy was it?
Cyclonic, Effie. We had to close every window in the house.
But
if you will just contain your natural feminine curiosity for a few moments, I'll be right down to dictate my report on the bow window caper.
Dashiell Hammett, America's leading detective fiction writer and creator of Sam Spade, the hard-boiled private eye, and William Spear, radio's outstanding producer-director of mystery and crime drama, join their talents to make your hair stand on end with the adventures of Sam Spade. Presented by the makers of Wild Root Cream Oil for the hair.
Yes, that's Howard Duff, our guest next month here on the Golden Age of Radio. And now until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel and the recordings of Ed Corcoran has been brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, serving Central Connecticut since 1889. Be sure to hear the next Golden Age of Radio broadcast Wednesday, November 28th, when our star will be actor Howard Duff. And you'll hear excerpts from the program that used to guarantee to make your hair stand on end, Sam Spade. With the engineering and technical assistance of Bob Schirago, the Golden Age of Radio is produced and edited by Brian Hartnett. This is Norm Peters.
Camel Cigarettes present Benny Goodman Swing School, the Tuesday evening rally of everybody everywhere who gets a lift from the new pulsating music of youth, swing.
The Lux Radio Theater brings you Rita Hayworth and Charles Corbin in This Love of Ours. Ladies and gentlemen, your producer, Mr.
The makers of Instant Chase and Sanborn Coffee present The Charlie McCarthy Show. This is Ken Carpenter, ladies and gentlemen, greeting you from Hollywood, California. On behalf of Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Sterr, Don Ameche, and Marcia Hunt, and the Bickersons by Bill Rapp. Play Dude.